From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. 15 days to slow the spread is now more like 45 days after President Trump extended social distancing guidelines that were supposed to end today through the end of April. The president defended the new approach today in an interview with Fox News. He also slammed House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who had criticized him for what she saw as a slow response.
All she did was focus on impeachment. She didn't focus on anything having to do with pandemics. She didn't focus on it. She focused on impeachment, and she lost, and she looked like a fool.
We're joined now by NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Mara, the president has changed his tune dramatically from last week when he was saying he hoped life could get back to normal by Easter. What changed his mind?
What changed his mind is that the president understood, came to understand that he was in a box. He wanted to run for re-election on the economy. He wanted a roaring stock market and low unemployment. But he came to understand that he couldn't solve the economic problem until he solved the virus problem. You know, when you're a reality TV producer, you want the season finale to be, quote, packed pews on Easter Sunday. But he listened to Dr. Fauci, who said there could be 200,000 deaths and that he could be blamed for that if you open up the economy too soon. More people get sick, start dying. That doesn't help the economy, and that hurts your reelection chances. So for now, he has sided with his public health experts, not the advisors who are telling him to open up the economy and that the cure is worse than the disease. And that's what he's decided to do, at least for now.
Well, and is there now consensus in Washington that the country should remain essentially locked down for another month? Or is there anybody saying, no, we got to open things up more quickly?
There are some voices saying that, but for now, the president has caught up with the governors. There is a consensus among mostly Democratic governors, some Republican governors, too. They are leading the way. They have already extended their restrictions until the end of April. Now the president is catching up with them. And what we see from public opinion polls are that voters overwhelmingly accept this painful trade-off. They're willing to take these restrictions, at least for now, rather than risk the public health.
Mara, the president has been having these daily press conferences, but they often end up being feisty back and forths with reporters. Here's what happened when a reporter with the PBS NewsHour, Yamiche Alcindor, asked a question yesterday.
Let me ask you.
You said some states.
Why don't you act in a little more positive? It's always trying to
get
you.
My question to you is,
get you. And you know what? That's why nobody trusts the media anymore.
Mara, the president has been in press conferences much more regularly than usual. What have you observed about these interactions with reporters?
He's very frustrated. He wants to make sure that people blame someone else other than him for economic pain, for sickness, for death. He wants them to blame governors. He has said famously, "I don't take any responsibility at all." You know, last week he even tweeted, quote, "The lamestream media is the dominant force in trying to get me to keep our economy closed as long as possible in the hopes it will be detrimental to my election success. The real people want to get back to work ASAP." At least that's what he said before he had a change of heart.
One more thing, just briefly, Mara, do you expect that there will be another huge relief bill from Congress before this thing is over?
Yes. Until you have a massive testing program that allows you to identify and isolate coronavirus cases, you have to keep socially distancing. You have to keep the economy in a medically induced coma. And that means you have to provide some economic life support. So, yes, I think there will be phase four. The phase three bill, the $2 trillion bill, only provided basically enough aid for 8 weeks of payroll. If it goes on longer than that, you're going to have to provide economic aid to keep the economy going longer than that.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, we've been checking in on states. Let's visit a couple. Massachusetts has more than 4,900 coronavirus cases. WBUR reporter Carrie Goldberg has been tracking them. And Carrie, some 150 people at Boston hospitals have tested positive. So start there. Are healthcare workers staying on top of this?
Well, they basically are, Robin, although there's a lot of concern about tight supplies of protective equipment here, as there are elsewhere. But, you know, Boston is known as this real medical mecca, and we have several big hospitals that are not overwhelmed at this point. Like last we heard from Massachusetts General Hospital, for example, is that it has 150 intensive care beds, and it can expand to 400. And so far, it has a couple of dozen COVID-19 patients in intensive care. So though we've had about 400 people hospitalized at latest count and 48 deaths, yeah, all of them older people, care system does seem to be handling it so far. But in preparation for the surge that's expected, we're also starting to see some nursing homes or hospital spaces converted to handle the virus.
And by the way, Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker announced Friday that anyone coming into Massachusetts has to self-quarantine.
That's right. And you can't help feeling that it's mostly directed at New York City, with New York City being in such tough shape and just a four-hour drive from Boston. So now there are like electronic road signs on the highways asking people to self-quarantine for 2 weeks. But, you know, Robin, in general, Massachusetts has dated social distancing, but not a shelter-in-place order. It seems like it doesn't need to get super tough because there is tremendous public support for the distancing measures. A recent poll found almost unanimous support for closing non-essential businesses and for obeying the social distancing measures. And support for Governor Baker and his performance in this crisis is extremely high. And not surprisingly, in this very Democratic state, you know, support for President Trump's handling of the crisis, not so much.
Well, and we should say Governor Baker is a Republican governor. And just briefly, just a few seconds we have, the streets are empty. You know, what's the mood here?
I'd say the mood is people are worried about their health and about their finances. But this recent poll also turned up a striking level of resilience, or you could call it fortitude. More than half of people said they thought they could emotionally endure at least a few more months of the current situation.
Yeah. WBUR reporter Carrie Goldberg. Resilience is the word. And Carrie, thanks so much. Well, meanwhile, Michigan has the most coronavirus cases in the U.S. after New York, New Jersey, and California. Detroit has been the hardest hit. The Detroit metro area includes Oakland County. David Coulter is Oakland County executive. David, more than 5,000 cases in the state of Michigan, but your county alone, over 1,200 cases. I'm assuming that trajectory still is going up.
Yeah, we're still in the upward trajectory of this curve, and I suspect that that'll be the case for at least the remainder of this week.
What's your biggest problem? I mean, we know it's congested. People live closely together. What's your biggest issue?
People are taking the stay-at-home order very seriously, and so that's become less of an issue. Our biggest need right now is the needs of our hospitals, and we are at capacity now with our hospitals, and we're working with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and others to help us get additional beds in place, but that's going to be the greatest need this week.
Yeah, and we spoke to a doctor in New York. They said there's a mobile hospital being set up in Central Park. Are you thinking of that kind of thing when you think of extra beds?
Yeah, we're talking about converting our convention center in downtown Detroit to about 4,900 extra beds. In Oakland County, we're looking at additional sites. We're actually working with our universities to see if we can convert residence halls or arenas. We're going to need the space, and we're going to need it soon.
And you also need the protective equipment that everyone needs. Your county has banned foreclosures through the end of 2020. First of all, are you worried about what happens to your banking system? Are you worried about what happens if that many mortgages don't get paid through the entire year? And are you worried, you know, on the other hand, you know, renters, people paying mortgage, April 1st is coming up. Some people have no money, no reserves to pay their rents.
You know, I worry about the economics of this a great deal, and it's going to hit us in a number of ways, from our small businesses to our renters to the folks paying mortgages like you indicated. But the best thing we can do for our economics is to make the pandemic as short as we can. And so we're still very, very focused on the public health aspects of this. But we know that there are going to be significant economic hardships from this, and we're planning those at the same time. But public health has to trump right now.
What are you saying about people who are looking at April 1st and saying they can't pay their rent? Are you going to tell landlords they can't demand it?
We're looking at all of those things. I think the great news is that a lot of landlords and businesses have stepped up and understood this need themselves. Our utility companies, for instance, without any prodding from us, have stopped shutoffs, although the governor has made that part of her order as well. So really across the board, we're seeing the business community step up and do the responsible thing. And where they're not, that's, I think, a role for us to help encourage them.
Well, look, after the housing collapse, tons of money was poured into the economy. It seemed to jumpstart just fine. So maybe we can go that route. Before we let you go, your county has seen people in their 20s hospitalized and people in their 30s and 40s die. What do you say to young people right now?
Take it seriously. It can affect everybody. This virus hits all age groups. And I think that initial message we had about seniors being most at risk, that's still true, but it can hit everybody. We just lost a state legislator from Detroit yesterday, and he was a younger person. Mm. So it is not a respecter of age or race, and everybody needs to take this incredibly serious.
That's Oakland County Executive David Coulter there in Michigan, Detroit area. David, thanks so much.
I appreciate being with you.
And best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Well, what do you want us to know about what's happening in your state? We want to get to them all. Go to this story at hearnow.org. Let us know. Or go to our Facebook page. Just stay in touch.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
We got the sad news over the weekend of the first infant death from coronavirus in this country, in Illinois. The governor there said experts tell him the mortality rate for children is still very low. But what about women who are pregnant? There are new rules at hospitals aimed at limiting expectant moms' exposure to COVID-19 during childbirth, but some pregnant women are still looking for alternatives to the hospital. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav reports.
Nikki MacGyver Brown's phone's been ringing a lot lately.
Here's one here. She is calling about the coronavirus.
The certified nurse midwife sits in an exam room. A sticker on her open laptop reads, "Midwife at your cervix." She plays a message from a recent call.
I am 4 months pregnant and currently being seen at a doctor's hospital who had an outbreak of corona, and it's now closed, and I am looking to transfer care to a home birth or birth center.
Brown owns San Antonio Nurse Midwife Birth Center in Garden Ridge, Texas. She says she's been getting 20 calls like that a week from women considering birthing centers and home births. That's double the number she usually gets.
Probably about 70% are about COVID and 30% are about the support people.
Brown says most of these women are worried about hospitals exposing them and their newborns to the disease. Others don't like recent rule changes limiting the number of people allowed at the birth. It used to be as many as 3. Now it's just 1.
So it's really causing a lot of them to become anxious, and it is wrecking their plans.
Set amongst green fields and foggy skies, the feel of this home-turned birthing center is about as far from what you would imagine an urban hospital to be. They have 2 birthing suites, and Brown often does home births. She says she delivered 59 babies last year. As we talk, a woman pulls up outside Brown's office. Brown calls her.
I see you.
Hi.
I was going to ask your questions while you were in the car. You ready?
Okay.
The physical checkup will be face-to-face, but to limit exposure, Brown starts the check-in interview outside.
Tell me about that call.
That was a cough.
I know.
I'm just clearing my throat. I haven't been outside of my house for 2 weeks.
Dr. Shirsi Agard says the hospital is still the best place for all moms to give birth.
We've got decades of data outside of COVID-19 saying it is safer for women not to give birth at home.
She's a professor of obstetrics at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston and says many women are asking questions about how COVID could impact their pregnancy or birth.
We simply don't know. We wish we could tell everybody, don't worry about it, it'll be fine. But we don't know that yet.
Now flu season is looking like a trip to Disneyland because this is just outrageous.
Claudia Quinto lives in San Antonio and should give birth in the next month. She plans on delivering in the hospital, but COVID-19 is complicating her plan.
And if I get too stressed, it could, activate labor.
Quinto self-quarantined for 15 days, only venturing out for checkups. And she had hoped to have her husband and her sister with her when she gave birth. Her hospital says her sister can't be there. And there's a chance hospitals could further restrict who can be in the room. When asked what she would do if she had to birth with no emotional support people, Cuento said she didn't know, but probably would still go to the hospital. Her husband, Joey Cuento, a nurse, says if he has a vote, it's for the hospital.
I know her answer is maybe yes, maybe no, but for me, it would be a definite yes, because if there is anything that happens, you know, any kind of emergency, she's already at a place where they can perform those types of things.
Hospitals in Texas are still able to keep pace with cases of COVID-19, but if the curve isn't flattened and hospital beds become scarce, it's not yet clear what that may mean for expectant moms. For Here and Now, I'm Paul Flav.
Well, for those of us who've been stuck at home for the last couple weeks, there can be a feeling of isolation, which can be especially tough for people who are recovering from addiction. Many rely on group support networks to survive. Joining us now is Vic Vella, who's the host of Back from Broken, a new recovery podcast from Colorado Public Radio. Vic, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jeremy.
And we should say, first of all, this is an issue that is personal to you. You are in recovery yourself.
Yeah, a little more than 5 years sober now.
Wow. Well, good for you. And what are you telling people who, like you, are recovering from addiction and having to deal with being alone so much and being stuck at home in many cases?
You know, it's tough. First of all, I've been checking in with a lot of friends since the COVID outbreak started, and just hearing like a different variety of responses. You know, some people are doing okay, but others, you know, might not have been so secure in their recovery to begin with. You know, some may have just been starting out. Some may have had some troubles along the way. Just the other day, I spoke with a friend who relapsed, started drinking again. You know, he was struggling before the outbreak, but when his job pushed him into isolation, he didn't know what to do with his day. You know, he was so used to like being active and doing stuff and communicating with people and going to meetings. And then all of a sudden that just all came to a screeching halt. And now he's just 24 hours to himself. And that's a long time to be in your head when you're an addict. And so he started drinking again. And luckily, thankfully, he's doing better. And thankfully, he's the only one I've talked to who that's happened to. But it's not easy. It's not easy when you're alone as an addict, because oftentimes, especially for me, isolation meant getting high. You know, I was a cocaine addict for many, many years. And you think of cocaine as a social drug, right? You go out to the club or bar with your friends and then you just talk all night. And that was true early on. But toward the as my addiction worsened, I became isolated in my use, and I would just close the blinds and go into the basement and get high all night. And so when I'm alone all day, that can be a trigger. Just being alone in and of itself can be a trigger for a lot of people.
So what are you doing to keep that from happening?
Well, me, thankfully today I'm secure in my recovery in that I have a good roadmap. You know, a few things. When this whole thing started, I knew that there was going to come a time when I would have to be at home alone a lot. I'm a single guy. I have a dog, which is great. She keeps me company. But for the most part, I would have to spend most of my hours alone. So what am I going to do about that? And it's the old serenity prayer, you know, the courage to, you know, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. I can't change what's happening in the world, but I can change how I view things. So I have chosen to view this time not as a barrier, but as sort of a, you know, a positive thing, you know, an opportunity, if you will. You know, how many times would I say to myself, gosh, I don't have enough time in the day to meditate? Well, now I have all day.
Right.
So now getting back into daily and evening meditation practices. I was really active before the outbreak happened, so I ordered some dumbbells. I got some at-home workout pointers from a friend who used to do workouts in a prison cell. So, I mean, I think the thing with people in addiction is that we have overcome a lot of things. And so we're really crafty around, we were really crafty when we were getting high in terms of hustling to find drugs. And then we were crafty in terms of figuring out how to live life without drugs. So we've overcome a lot, and we really can overcome this. The biggest thing, Jeremy, is for people to not look, isolation doesn't mean alone, okay? And find three friends who you can talk to every single day. Make sure you have one friend who is your, whether it's a friend in recovery or not, someone who's a break glass in case of emergency friend, you know, if you're having thoughts of relapse. There's a lot of online meetings, and at first I didn't think they would be fun, but they're actually kind of a blast, because not only are you talking about the things that are causing you struggles at this time, everyone's just kind of in it together, you know? And so they joke about the pajamas they're wearing, or or they're grateful that they're not having to drink that awful coffee that we get at meetings, you know? So it's not so bad.
And what can people who know somebody who either has an addiction or has had an addiction, what can they do to reach out and help at this time? What would be useful?
Just check on them. I think there's a few things. First of all, praise them. Give them praise for the fact that they're staying sober today. Look, we can't take that ever for granted. You can't assume that someone's doing great in their recovery. Oh, this guy's been 5 years sober. He must be doing well. No, give them credit for getting through another day. Because often right now, we don't have those in-person meetings for that, you know, for people to praise us. We're used to getting up in front of meetings and getting a chip, and everyone applauds us and we get hugs. That's a huge part of recovery communities, and we're not getting that right now. So anything you could do to really pat someone on the back, that's huge. And then just, you know, it's basic human decency to just say, hey, is there anything I can do for you? Do you want to talk? Do you want to talk about something serious? Do you want to talk about the 2002 World Series? I mean, it doesn't have to be about recovery. It can just be about, you know, let's just talk.
Well, Vic, keep meditating and keep exercising. And I'm sure that a lot of people are going to try to take some of your advice today, whether they're dealing with addiction or know somebody who is. A very good advice from Vic Vella, who is the host of Back from Broken. That's a new recovery podcast from Colorado Public Radio. Vic, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And if you are dealing with addiction and you found ways to cope with social distancing, we'd love to hear from you at hereandnow.org.
The first of the month is around the corner, and that means bills, which maybe you, maybe for the first time in your life, can't pay. Now, last Friday, President Trump signed into law a $2 trillion coronavirus response bill known as the CARES Act. So let's take a look there. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst for CBS News, host of Jill on Money. And Jill, we know there's relief for small businesses, loans for big corporations, direct payments to Americans. So start there. How much, who gets it, when?
So the direct payments are $1,200 per adult, and that's as long as you have income. And income is counted as wages, Social Security, a pension, up to $75,000. That doubles, $150,000 if you're married filing jointly. You'll get two checks. Now, here's something interesting. From $75,000 to $99,000 of adjusted gross income, you'll get some amount of money. It'll be sort of smaller as you go up the food chain there. Above $100,000 or $198,000 if you're married filing jointly, you won't get anything. And those folks who qualify for those income levels will also receive $500 per child. I should just note one thing, and that is a lot of people were asking me about this. Are these taxable to recipients? They are not. Mm-hmm. But remember, they could be adjusted if you're relying on tax returns that later come to be understating your income.
Right. And by the way, this is income you're not making right now. But this is, you know, not going to come by April 1st, and it's not going to help families far. I mean, it's going to be a help, but not going to get them far. So tell me, what do you have to prove to try to get, you know, this expanded unemployment insurance benefits? What do you have to do to get that?
Well, I think that's really the key to this program when it comes to individuals, those enhanced employment benefits, which are usually administered by individual states. So, you know, for example, the state of Massachusetts has an unemployment insurance plan, and you would basically file for unemployment benefits in your state of residence, and normally you would get up to a maximum of 26 weeks. Well, the CARES Act adds 13 weeks on top of that, and also what the CARES Act does is it actually gives you an additional $600 per week on top of what your state unemployment program will pay, and that's for another 4 months. This is important. I think this is a very big part of how some people are going to be able to stay afloat during this time.
And it applies to people who never used to be in unemployment, gig workers, part-time workers. What do you have to prove there?
Well, you know, that's really the benefit of this. Previously, if you were, again, like an independent contractor, just a freelancer or part-timer, someone who's furloughed, you would not qualify for unemployment. Now, all of these people will qualify. You know, it's estimated that there are about 57 million of these types. This could be a sole proprietor as well. And in fact, because these people had been shut out of benefits, they were freaking out when this whole national emergency began. They will be part of it. It will not be a huge burden of proof. You should just go ahead and file in your state of residence.
And so we got the first of the month coming. Can you ask your landlord to, you know, hey, can I catch you next month on the rent? Can you ask utilities to wait? What's going on?
Yes, you absolutely can. Just to be clear about rent, the bill, it puts together a moratorium for renters whose landlords have mortgages that are backed or owned by a federal agency, meaning Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. 120 days after the bill passes, ask for it. Ask the same for utilities. Ask for your internet service providers. Ask for credit card holders. Every single bill you have, ask for forbearance.
Ask for
get
help.
On the record.
Jill Schlesinger, thanks as always.
Take care.
Remember the trade war with China? Well, it's still going on, and it includes about $5 billion worth of tariffs on medical products from China. President Trump said Friday that reports he's considering pulling back on those tariffs are not true. Our next guest argues that would be a mistake, that the tariffs are hampering America's fight against COVID-19. Chad Bown is a senior fellow and trade policy expert at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He joins us now. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And you point to some Chinese medical products that are now harder to get because of the tariffs?
Yeah, so you know, everybody's probably familiar with the fact that for the last 2 years, the Trump administration has waged this trade war with China. And so when I looked into the data, it turns out that a lot of the medical supplies that the American medical community needs right now to fight the COVID-19 pandemic, a lot of those were hit with tariffs. Some of them have been removed, but I think what those tariffs ultimately did is they made it much more difficult for hospitals and, you know, medical and emergency respondent suppliers to be able to prepare for a pandemic like what we're seeing today.
Well, and before the tariffs, how much did the U.S. rely on China for medical products?
So before the tariffs went on, it was about 25% or so of our overall imports of these products. Now, we do produce a lot of these things in the United States. We buy, you know, a fair amount from other countries as well. But China really was a pretty significant source for a lot of the equipment that our responders need.
So after the tariffs went into effect on these products, did the U.S. just get them from another country, produce on its own, or do we just have fewer medical supplies than we used to?
Well, it's hard to answer that question precisely. When I looked at the data, there are imports of these products coming in from other countries, but it doesn't look like they're coming in at a much greater rate from these other countries that would fill the gap that China's lost sales into the U.S. market would have expected us to see. And a lot of these items, you can't just switch and find an alternative supplier somewhere out there. It can take 1-2 years for a manufacturing facility to be certified by the Food and Drug Administration. You know, a lot of these are safety items, and we want to make sure that they're safe. And so it's not as easy to switch as one might hope.
So given that, and obviously the Trump administration has realized that this is a problem, they've actually temporarily reduced some tariffs on some Chinese goods. Have they solved the problem? Are there still tariffs on Chinese medical products that we need to fight coronavirus?
I think there likely still are, and I think the administration likely thinks that there still are some tariffs in effect as well. They have excluded temporarily some of the products, but basically what they've done there is they've responded to requests by American companies to have these tariffs removed. And they just put out another call and said, hey, you know, if we haven't taken the tariffs off something that you want to buy, let us know and we'll consider it. Obviously, you know, there's probably a lot of buyers out there that haven't been paying attention to the details of the back and forth of the trade war, and they don't know about this. Now they're fighting a pandemic. And so this really is kind of a haphazard way of making it easier for the American medical community to get these sources from wherever they can possibly get them from at this stage.
Aside from specific items that have tariffs on them that the U.S. may now need and they want to get rid of those tariffs, do you think that the trade war as a whole has made it more difficult for the Trump administration to deal with coronavirus because the relationship is strained between the U.S. and China at a time when data sharing in particular would be very useful?
Yeah, I think absolutely. You know, the Trump administration, in taking this approach with China, has really frayed relations. They've been very, very antagonistic. And even in the best of times, this pandemic is going to require a level of cooperation globally that we have never experienced before. And right now, we are basically starting off at kind of the lowest point almost that one could imagine between the United States and China. So there's going to take a lot of work for the U.S. administration to be able to engage more proactively with China so that everybody can come up with, you know, positive solutions to help deal with this crisis.
That is Chad Bown, who's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, now that the social distancing guidelines have been extended to the end of April, you might be looking for a good read or two or three. Joining us with some suggestions is Petra Mayer of NPR Books. Hi, Petra.
Hi, Jeremy.
And I have to say, I have a few books that I've got to read right now, and I have not found the motivation yet to do so because there's so much going on. But is there something about this time, which is so scary for so many people, that makes you just want to curl up with a book?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a couple of reasons. Obviously, there's just sheer escapism, right? Why not take a moment to visit somewhere where the problems aren't yours? But also, especially in science fiction and fantasy and genre fiction, those are often areas where we game out ways to overcome problems in society right now. So Emily St. John Mandel has been on Twitter telling people not to read Station 11, but honestly, do it. Pandemic fiction is important right now.
All right. So tell us some of the books that you have on your list that people might be interested in this time of self-isolation.
Well, what I'm doing is sort of getting through big fantasy series that I abandoned and feel bad about. So I am going to go back to Ken Liu's epic Dandelion Dynasty series. It's set in this island empire, and the cruel old emperor is dying, and the empire that he brought together is crumbling, and there's a story of a friendship and a revolution and the games that gods play in big battles. And I got part of the way through the sequel and kind of wandered away from it and never went back. It's called The Wall of Storms. It's what happens after the revolution. The other thing that I'm doing right now is getting into authors that I feel embarrassed that I know so little about. You know, for somebody who's a sci-fi and fantasy fan, the fact that I've only read one Octavia Butler book is kind of shameful, and I can't believe I'm copping to it on national radio. So I am going to read Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents. And again, those are dystopian. You know, they're set in America of the 2020s that has just completely collapsed due to inequality and climate change and become this fundamentalist dystopia. So maybe a little on the nose, but you know, if you're not going to think about those things now, when are you going to think about them?
I thought we were going for escapism here, Petra, but
yeah, okay, I know. Sorry.
I want to ask you about books about New York City, because New York has become the center in the United States, at least right now, of the coronavirus. You have some suggestions for books that celebrate New York.
I do, yeah. Let's start with James McBride. His new one is called Deacon King Kong, and it starts with an actual literal bang. There's this cranky old church deacon, and he walks into the courtyard of his Brooklyn housing project, and he shoots the local drug dealer, who dodges, and he only loses an ear, but the effects of the shooting just ripple out. I mean, that's a horribly reductive way of describing the book, because it's just this dizzyingly rich portrait of New York from every possible angle. Like, I mean, one chapter is actually narrated by a colony of ants in the housing project. So it's James McBride, who's a jazz musician in his spare time. So that definitely comes through in the writing. It's just a wonderful read. Then there's N.K. Jemisin, who just won 3 Hugo Awards in a row for her Broken Earth trilogy, which is set on this world that might be a far future Earth. But her new one is called The City We Became, and it is set in New York. And it's a world where cities, if they are big and lively enough, can actually come alive. So New York has been born in the form of this scruffy street kid, and he has to battle this interdimensional evil, which at first knocks him out, so he's out of commission. And then the city awakens these 5 other people who represent the boroughs, and they have to come together to fight this evil. And you can tell that Jemisin just knows the city down to its bones, and it comes out in the writing and the descriptions. You know, if you haven't been to New York, you will feel that you have if you've read this book.
All right, you've also got a nonfiction selection, and it's Charles Dickens' A Life by British author Claire Tomalin. Why?
Yeah, this is a funny one. A dear friend of mine, her dad is very literary, and when this book came out, he was giving it to everyone he knew, including me. And I could care less about Dickens, right? Like, I was in Oliver when I was a little kid, but that's about it. And this book just made me care. It brought him alive. I mean, it's corny, but like, you could say that his life was Dickensian. His father was thrown into debtor's prison. Like, at the age of 12, he was working in a bootblack factory, and then he hustled and got rich. You know, and there's so much more to the story. The book puts him in 3 dimensions at the center of this big web of friends and family, and you learn about all the various flaws in his character. But what I love about it is how novelistic the detail is. I mean, you can just practically see the cobblestones and smell the damp plaster. And I finally actually went back and started reading Great Expectations. That was how much this book made me care about Dickens.
You were an Oliver. I was Winnie the Pooh when I was a little kid in a community production.
I hope there are pictures.
I hope there are not pictures. That is Petra Mayer of NPR Books. We'll have all of Petra's picks at hereandnow.org. Petra, thanks and stay safe.
My pleasure. You too.
When Dr. Fauci warned yesterday during the task force briefing that as many as 200,000 Americans could die of COVID-19, the president took that number seriously. He also welcomed a friendly question about his high press briefing ratings. Despite what health experts see as a month lost to Trump's downplaying of the virus, 6.2 million viewers have been watching his briefings on Fox, whose marquee hosts also downplayed the crisis early on. New York Times reporter Ben Smith asked one health expert if he felt people will die because of the Fox coverage. The answer, yes. Ben, what were some Fox hosts saying?
When you started to see a lot of criticism of President Trump's early handling of the crisis, Fox News hosts really rushed to his defense and focused totally on attacking the media, attacking Democrats, attacking anybody who criticized Trump, often at the expense of actually covering the virus. And so you saw Sean Hannity, the most watched voice on cable news, call the coverage a hoax. You had Trish Regan, a Fox Business host, call it a scam. A chorus of voices saying it was nothing worse than the flu.
We actually have Trish Regan with the words coronavirus impeachment scam behind her saying this.
This is yet another attempt to impeach the president. And sadly, it seems they care very little for any of the destruction they are leaving in their wake.
But then, Ben, you point out that Fox made a pivot here. They pulled her off the anchor chair. And here's where you make a bigger point about the network. You say that when owner Rupert Murdoch stepped back, turned over the reins to a son, Lachlan, the network seemed more like an asylum in the firm control of inmates, in the thrall of a president, beyond the control of the Murdochs. Explain why, because you had a chief executive of Fox News, Suzanne Scott. You have Lachlan Murdoch. Was nobody paying attention?
I would say that when Trump started taking the virus seriously, those hosts did too. And the network took kind of sort of symbolic action by taking this host, Trish Regan, off the air. I think most people had probably only heard of Trish Regan and the fact that she had a show when she was taken off the air, and leaving all the important people alone. But what's so striking to me, and when I was calling up and saying, well, what happened here? You know, how did this kind of disaster unroll for a few weeks? Was the sense that nobody was really in charge. The CEO of the network, Suzanne Scott, who was appointed in the aftermath of a sexual misconduct scandal that took out the very powerful chairman of Fox News, Roger Ailes, and she knew, she took coronavirus seriously. She was sanitizing the cafeterias and doing things like that in late February, but she just didn't have the power to control these big voices like Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham. And her boss, the CEO of Fox Corp, Lachlan Murdoch, again, I think there's no evidence the Murdochs didn't personally take it seriously. They canceled Rupert Murdoch's 89th birthday party, in fact, because they were concerned about coronavirus. But he made no apparent effort to get the people who worked for him to kind of give good information about public health.
Well, as we said, things have changed. That chief executive, Suzanne Scott, has demanded of Fox and Friends, the morning show, that they have a doctor that appears on the panel who actually knows what he's talking about after other disinformation. But what else is happening inside the network, given that it appears that at least for a couple of weeks, they were downplaying what is now a tremendous pandemic?
I mean, I would say that it does not, I don't think they really have much more control over the network than they did. I think the whole episode proved the extent to which these folks work for Donald Trump rather than for Fox or the Murdochs. And the most remarkable thing in my reporting was the extent to which everybody is pointing fingers at each other at this point. Some of them, like Sean Hannity in particular, deny that they ever got anything wrong or that they or Trump didn't take this seriously, even as Trump was in fact saying that the situation was under control and things like that. But also, Rupert Murdoch has told people close to him that he's the one who pulled Hannity back into line by getting in touch with him. And Hannity, on the record, says that never happened. Some of the network are upset at Tucker Carlson, who was the one host who did take it seriously and who then had given some media interviews about that. And I think other people at the network feel like he's making himself look good at their expense. You know, blame is going kind of up and down the whole system there.
Well, and it would seem to continue the symbiotic relationship between what Fox hosts are saying and what the president then says when he goes to his task force briefings. There was that Fox town hall on a Sunday night, and the weekend host, Steve Hilton, said in his opening monologue that Americans will be crushed by the closure of business and the loss of paychecks. Hilton said, you know that famous phrase, the cure is worse than the disease. Well, then we see the president showing up using that phrase and talking about ending the restrictions sooner than later. It doesn't seem as if this kind of messaging back and forth between Fox News and the Trump administration is at all altered, despite that finger pointing.
No, if anything, I think it's sort of become clearer the sway Trump holds there. And that relationship is obviously kind of very circular and tight.
Well, we began by quoting from Ashish Jha. This is the director of the Harvard Global Public Health Institute. You asked him whether he believed people will die because of Fox's coverage. And by the way, he's been on Fox. But he said, yes, some commentators in the right-wing media spread a very specific type of misinformation that I think has been harmful. Do you think that the Murdochs should be held responsible for that?
They are, in fact, responsible. Lachlan is the CEO of this company. Rupert is the chairman.
Ben Smith, New York Times reporter, will link you to his writing about Fox News at hereandnow.org. Ben, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.